Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:13 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 12th, and of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off this week with Google. The share has been rallying pretty impressively since the beginning of this year. It's, I think, very interesting to look at it from a longer-term perspective because it had been one of the most consistently trending markets in the world until about the beginning of 2018. If we look at the chart all the way from the breakout in 2013, then we had this beautiful staircase step sequence uptrend. And each one of these little ranges was about $100. And every breakout from the top of the last range went up by about $100. So there was a rhythmic move that had been going on, that had been underway for about 5 years. Then we had a $200 advance from the top of the move, and then we had a $200 pullback. Well, that was the largest pullback we'd seen in quite some time. Then the price went right back up and went back to another $100 increment advance. So it got up to $1,300, but then it pulled back by $300. So then we started to see that this trend had really started to lose consistency. And now we are back around the $1,220 area. So this has been a very impressive $200 rally. And there's obviously the big question now as to whether it is going to be capable of reasserting the previous consistent trending environment, or whether we're still in a much more choppy trading environment. And it's too early to draw that conclusion because, in order to really convince everybody that the worst has passed, then Google will have to not only push above $1,200, it'll have to push on to $1,400 and then find support at least the $1,200 area. And that's a bit of an ask at the moment. Doesn't necessarily mean it won't happen, but we've definitely had a very impressive move over the course of the last 3.5 months. It's not over just yet. But when we see a market that has previously been incredibly consistent become less consistent, well, then that does raise red flags. I think, force us to ask the question as to what can we expect next? Well, obviously for Google, it has been a massive beneficiary of being able to capture the attention of the globe in terms of search engine optimization. So that has allowed it to build an advertising and marketing empire. The purchase of YouTube was also a master stroke because it created an additional outlet for the provision of marketing. The introduction of the Android system for operating system for mobile devices was another master stroke. Because what that did effectively was create a massive data pool against which the company could begin to market. So that's an additional feature. The introduction of smart speakers is an additional way of putting data in front of people, and also from gathering data that they can monetize later. So those are the clear beneficiary. Excuse me, I need to cough. Sorry about that. Well, that's basically already been reflected in the price. So what's next? Well, companies like Google are actively looking at trying to make their way into the one area that hasn't really been a factor in terms of visual advertising, which is the car. Most of the marketing that we are susceptible to when driving either comes via the radio or from ads by the side of the road. But considering the size of the screens that are now being installed in cars, well, then that represents a clear way for the people riding around to be marketed to as well. But there is a broader question. It's the very fact that we have this emerging debate about what kind of regulation should these types of companies be under. When we've seen, for example, that the conventional programming that we get in televisions and the kinds of things that are under heavy regulation, well, they can't, for example, market infomercials to children, but that is exactly what happens via YouTube. Well, there's obviously a backlash coming against that. Then there is the ability to promulgate rather nefarious content, such as the massacre in New Zealand, and it was very difficult for the social media type companies and search engines to excise that kind of content from their forums. So that's obviously something that is going to create a question about regulation. But then, of course, you have in normal circumstances, you would have competition. Well, Google doesn't really have competition in terms of its search right now. It's probably going to have competition in terms of the battle to gain eyes from the emergence of autonomous vehicles, for example. And that's also another reason why the company has been engaged in autonomous vehicles, because if as soon as you take someone's hands off of the wheel, then they become the sub they are locked in a cubicle and become the subject of or they're at least open to additional marketing and advertising. So that's a good reason for why they would be interested in autonomous vehicles. Now, when we look at the chart, there is obviously potential for additional upside. But then there is the question about the regulation that we're getting. There is the threat of regulation. Capitalism trends towards consolidation, and we've definitely seen a very clear trend of consolidation within the technology sector. That's equally true of Facebook. Facebook doesn't have a great deal of competition in social media at the moment. That's despite the fact that that Snap has been rallying over the course of the last few months. It's still not even remotely close to the kind of market penetration that Facebook via the Facebook app, Instagram, WhatsApp has. What's also particularly interesting is that following the massive downside Q reversal we had in the middle of last year, which contributed to a very deep pullback and which also represented a very large upset in terms of the trend's consistency. And in fact, there was another example here where we saw a larger pullback before it moved to another high and then the much bigger pullback later. So again, this is another example of a previously consistent trend losing consistency at the penultimate high. And that's something that we talk about at the chart seminar. Now, that also, of course, has to be considered when we see that there is obviously a clear trend now towards recovery. We've had a really quite impressive rebound. We've had a consolidation in the region of the trend mean, and now the price is starting to move higher. Capitalism trends towards consolidation is exemplified again in terms of Facebook. So that's a very clear trend as well, and it's hard to imagine that we're going to get a much larger social media company. That doesn't mean that we're not going to see additional platforms opening up, but will Facebook then just either copy them like it did with Snapchat, or is it going to simply go out and buy them? That's certainly a question. And then, of course, there is the risk that they're going to be more closely regulated. So that's perhaps the biggest threat to these kinds of companies, because the natural way that if we were to, well, let me be a little bit more succinct. If capitalism trends towards consolidation, eventually we'd end up with one company. But obviously, we haven't ended up with one company. So the counterbalance to that argument is that we're going to have antitrust. And that is becoming an increasingly likely prospect. You have, for example, a strike going on right now that is affecting Ahold Delhaize's operations in the northeast of the USA, and you've got Elizabeth Warren marching with the protesters, animating for higher wages. So there is this revolutionary aspect to the emerging political discourse, and that represents a challenge for these kinds of companies. There is perhaps no company that has become more the subject of antitrust calls than Amazon. And Amazon is also another share that had been trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner. When we look at it on a logarithmic scale chart, then we can see, I don't have this chart annotated, but we've had 30% pullbacks previously. This pullback here was a 35% pullback. It's more normal to see 10% pullbacks, but the bigger pullbacks have been buying opportunities. That's what people are betting now. If we go back and look at the arithmetic scale chart, well, I think we can clearly see that the price paused at 1,000, it paused at 1,500, and it paused at 2,000. Well, if you were to ask anybody, where do you think the next target is? Well, people are going to be saying 2,500. And considering that the price is currently at 1,845, then that's a pretty impressive advance, even from these levels. Giving credence to that view, of course, is to assume that the antitrust calls are not going to be successful. And they're unlikely to be successful in the current administration of the USA, but there is no telling who is going to be in charge of the next administration of the USA. For example, you have one of the Democratic candidates that is advocating for. The first thing he's going to do when he gets into office is to create universal basic income. So that's obviously a challenge. And well, I guess there is very little chance that Yang is going to be the one that actually becomes president, but one never knows. Well, again, Amazon has done very well by creating a market that it can dominate. And that it is moving into an increasingly large number of markets. That does hold out the prospect eventually that it will be broken up because it will get to a point where it has a very clear competitive advantage, but it's not there yet. The online market for, or relative to the physical market for goods, is still. It's not even half the size of the physical market, but it does dominate the market for things that are easy to move around. Because when we start to talk about the size of the retail market, that also includes autos. And while eBay has long done a good trade in selling cars on the second-hand market, Amazon isn't in that business. Then another big part of retail is healthcare, and Amazon is really only just beginning to get into that with health insurance and pharmaceuticals. So there is ample potential for Amazon to do better than it has already done by moving into additional new business lines. Eventually, though, it is going to have to deal with the clear risk of the fact that its success is going to breed calls for antitrust. Regardless of whether those calls for a breakup are justified or not. But what I find particularly interesting right now is that we have not yet had the consolidation in terms of the streaming market. In fact, what we're starting to see here is that we're probably now just at the beginning of a price war. And Disney today announced their Disney Plus, or the release of their Disney Plus streaming service, which has been much anticipated over the course of the last while. And they are pricing it substantially below Netflix's price at $6.99 versus $11. That is a significant saving, but of course it's not an awful lot of money to begin with. But perhaps the more important point is that they are pulling their programming from other services to concentrate on their own. There's a strong likelihood they're going to bundle ESPN in with the other programming. And as a result of the Fox merger, they now own more than half of Hulu. So this is certainly Disney starting to stake a very clear path towards the dominance of content creators. And that's a sea change, because with the the advent of broadband and mobile devices and the smart TV, what we have now seen is that the content creators no longer have any need for distribution, which is obviously a challenge for the cable companies. What's also interesting is that there is a rather thick field here. Netflix has pioneered that approach, but the bigger question now is whether it can hold onto it. The clear conclusion here is that it was also trending higher in a reasonably progressive manner. It had a range in 2014. It had a range between the middle of 2015 and the end of 2016. Then it started trending higher. It accelerated higher in 2018. Then it pulled back violently, coming from 425 to 250 in a rather short period of time. We've had an impressive rebound, and now potentially we're seeing a lower rally high. There is a clear difference between companies like Netflix and Google, Facebook, and Amazon in that the first three have profits and Netflix doesn't. And when we start to think about what that represents, well, we can see, for example, that 97% of their earnings come from their streaming service. But when we start to look at their revenue, that's also been growing, we should perhaps be able to see just how much they've been spending. I think that is in the key stats sector. Well, if we look at their free cash flow, the condition is expected to get a bit better this year, but we're still talking about spending more than almost $3 billion to the negative. Well, Disney is talking about spending $1 billion in terms of the kind of programming that it's going to produce for its streaming service. So Netflix is outspending everybody else, but it's spending other people's money. And it's obviously assuming that by spending and going out and buying shows and producing its own shows, that it's going to be able to maintain that lead in terms of subscribers. But it doesn't have the recognizable franchises that other content producers have. The other point I'd be rather interested to hear is how many people really continue to watch Netflix. I find a lot of the shows that Netflix are producing to be kind of boring, and I never seem to get past more than one or two episodes. I find that the kind of productions that Amazon are producing tend to be better. They don't produce as many, but they do tend to be of a better quality. And there definitely is a cookie-cutter quality to a lot of what Netflix is churning out. Then, of course, you have the fact that it isn't simply that you've got three companies, But AT&T has got a streaming service for DC Comics. That share has been trending downwards for 3 years, and it pushed back above the trend mean in here this week. Well, this isn't the first time it's done that, but it does look like there is potential here for additional upside, considering the price has pulled back by so much already. Well, this is obviously a sector that is potentially now going to begin to trend towards consolidation, because the price war is going to knock out some of the most heavily indebted companies. Netflix is therefore a very clear risk in this type of situation, because it is a high yield credit. That's, I think, one of the more important points, particularly when we start to think about what the high yield markets have been doing. When, for example, we look at the fact that if we take, for example, one of Netflix's more longer dated bonds and look at the yield on that, it's not pricing in any risk. In fact, these yields have been coming down steadily from 5% to 3.5% over the course of the last month. So that's a, I think that's the market seeming to bet that there is nothing untoward here at all. And this is a double B minus rating. This to me stands out as something that is completely illogical. It's also, of course, trading just like high yield spreads are universally, and we had a new reaction low in here today. That's obviously something that is contributing to the more benign attitude that we have on Wall Street. But these kinds of conditions in the bond markets don't persist indefinitely. The fact that Netflix is spending, if we just simply look at the fact that they're going to spend almost 3 billion on, or they're going to spend more than 3 million than they actually have this year, and a bit less than that next year, well, that's going to be an additional $5 billion that they're going to have to fund from investors. That's a clear risk if subscriber growth starts to moderate because of competition from companies like Disney. And a default or a widening of risk parameters on Netflix is just the kind of thing that could have a deleterious effect on the high yield sector. The continued strength of the oil market is an additional factor why high yield spreads have been contracting. And oil prices have been rallying, and they continue to rally. They're up an additional 68 cents in here today. We have seen that the price has paused at 62.5. It's paused at 67.5. We're nearly at the 72.5 area. That would be an additional point where we might anticipate some resistance coming through if this is still a consistent trend. But I think the much bigger point here is that we have a range evolving. The lower side of the range is closer to 40. The upper side is towards the $80 area. We had a significant merger in here today between Anadarko and Chevron, and that is going to create another super major oil producer, but they're concentrating on the Permian Basin. We know that the break-even prices in the Permian are about $55. And considering that the IEA expects that there's going to be an additional 4 million barrels of oil produced by the USA within the next 6 years, a good share of that is going to come from the Permian. These types of mergers and the synergies that they are hoped at least to deliver should help to reduce the marginal cost of production. And that suggests that the lows that we can anticipate when prices do weaken will probably be somewhere around $40. It's going to be difficult for prices to move significantly below that level because the USA is now the marginal source of global production, And their break even is going to be around the somewhere between $50 and $55. And if prices go below that, then they're just going to stop drilling. And when you stop drilling at unconventional wells, then they quickly peak and you stop getting production. That's just not the same way that you could. That is, I think, one of the advantages of unconventional supply is that certainly it is more expensive to produce, but that supply is more elastic and can be managed to the price environment. The other thing, of course, is that when prices rally, they can also manage exposure. Well, oil today is trading in contango, excuse me, in backwardation, right the way across the curve. So there's no incentive at the present moment to hedge because you can get more for selling as much oil as you can produce today than you can for any point out in the future. It's not really until we start to see the price environment move back into contango that we'll then get hedging activity. That's when you start to see supply really pick up. And of course, that is then going to be when prices start to come back down again. Well, it's a global market, and the big question is at what point will OPEC start to pump again? They want to improve pricing as much as possible. They need that higher price to fund their budgets. A significant number of the Middle Eastern suppliers and indeed Russia depend on higher prices to fund operations, and most particularly in the case of the Middle Eastern countries, to fund rather lavish social programs. So that suggests that we are going to see higher prices, at least up towards the $80 area, but an awful lot of additional supply, particularly offshore and in Canada, becomes economic when you get up towards that $80 area. So it's going to be a big Rubicon if we are going to see prices move substantially above that level. Of course, this continued strength in the oil price is helping to compress high yield spreads. So that is generally positive for the equity markets. When we look at the high yield bond ETFs, then it was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here this week. And more importantly than that is that not only are spreads starting to pull back below the trend mean, but that the ETFs are starting to break their sequences of lower rally highs. And what this is suggesting is that we are now at a point where we're starting to see a reflation trade taking hold. When we start to think about the kinds of conditions that we have in the bond markets, we are starting to see some rather silly activity. One of those is this. When we look at, for example, the Greek 5-year government bond yield. Now, it is very much influenced by the markets and by the ECB's. One is writing off the debts that are at least part of the debt that Greece has got outstanding. But the yield today is at 2.17%. Now, I think we will put it on a decade-long chart just to highlight how much impact some of these bailouts have had on the yield, where the 5-year yield went from 70 to about 5% overnight. Well, it's at 2.71, excuse me, 2.17% right now. Now, if we look at a similar environment on US 5-year treasuries, it's at 2.37. So there's a 20 basis pickup in the yield for the US 5-year treasury over the Greek 5-year. And that's a pretty incredible set of circumstances that 5-year yields in the US are trading above those of Greece. Well, that is a measure of just how much the Greek economy is being influenced by the negative interest rates and negative deposit rates the LTRO program and the buying program that the ECB has in place. That is also a clear testament to just how much liquidity is flowing out there outside of the US market. So that's a significant issue. But it also suggests that these European bonds are trading at very rich levels. And that is pricing in that there is a clearly almost a recessionary risk in Europe. Well, Mario Draghi was saying this week they do not anticipate there's going to be a recession. But we know that the economic figures have been negative, that industrial production figures haven't been particularly impressive, and that the German economy just about avoided a recession in the fourth quarter of last year. And those are significant challenges. It does suggest that the ECB may have to adopt a more stimulative attitude over the course of the rest of the year. It's going to take them a while to start to come back around because they only just ended their quantitative easing program and they're probably going to have to restart it again. Well, what this is also rather suggestive of is that there are still risks that are outstanding in Europe relative to the USA. And then we have the fact that China is also stimulating. And China stimulating and the strength of the US economy are both rather important factors. So when we look at the global markets, there is a clear argument for a reflation trade because China is stimulating again. They are certainly back in credit creation mode. That is standing out now in terms of the resurgence in banks from the beginning of this year. There is some consolidation going on right now, but we can also see that the banks are now right in the region of their peak from back in 2015. And that's a clear leadership role relative to the performance of the A-share index, which is a long way from the peaks back in 2015. And it does look like we're going to get some consolidation. But I do think it's also likely that we are going to see not only credit creation and banks starting to lend more, but more fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus coming through from China. And they pretty much need to do that. That they've been weighing on the shadow banking sector for 3 years, and that has contributed to a rather significant pullback in terms of economic activity. Then you have the fact that on May 4th, you have the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen Square. On June 4th, you have the, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right. I think it's the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party. And then in October, you have the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. The last thing that the Chinese administration is going to want is a recessionary outcome when all of these types of rather emotional anniversaries are due this year. And that virtually ensures that we're going to have more credit creation. The performance of the stock market is state-sponsored in China. And we have evidence of state sponsorship right now, and that suggests that we are going to see additional upside. It also suggests that when that state sponsorship is eventually withdrawn, then that will be the time to move away from the market. Well, what we have, therefore, is with China, because of the state of governance, because we do not have respect for shareholder interests, and we do not have an independent judiciary, and we don't have a free press. In fact, what we do have is an increasingly authoritarian and arguably a fascist regime emerging, then that represents the fact that this is a trading market rather than an investor's market. What is, I think, even more important than that is the contrast now that you have between China and India. Because India is an emerging manufacturing hub. And that is something that was a laughable prospect a decade ago. It was the one thing that people were more than willing to say that China was going to be the workshop of the world indefinitely, and that India would never be able to get its act together. Well, India is now producing about 250 million iPhone Xs, and they anticipate getting up to about a billion in terms of production over the course of the next 5 or 6 years. And that's a technologically difficult piece of kit. And it requires some dainty work by workers, and it also represents a very clear incentive for India to get busy with producing the kind of infrastructure that is necessary to really drive manufacturing prowess. India has always had the consumer economy. They have had the system of governance and government that was inherited from the British Empire. Then they have the clear success stories from international success stories from the entrepreneurial spirit that has been I guess has flourished despite government policy over the years. But with Narendra Modi in power, there is a much more business-friendly administration. So that has contributed to continued outperformance. Well, the voting in the upcoming election started this week. It's going to persist for at least another 6 weeks. So we're not going to have an answer to whether Modi has in fact won the election until the end of May. But the stock market is certainly suggesting that he is going to win, and that will usher in an additional term where we're going to have a market-friendly environment. India has got a demographic dividend that is unparalleled in the world today. They have got approximately 600 million people under the age of 26 that are going to be looking for work over the course of the next couple of decades. There are going to be tens of millions of people voting for the first time in each of the next maybe 5 to 10 elections, and that represents a clear incentive for politicians to promote growth, openness, regulatory easing, and job creation. So that means that there's going to be credit growth in the Indian market. That has been one of the central platforms that both parties are running on. The banking sector remains a clear lead indicator, and it is at a new high. And again, there is risk of some consolidation in the short term, but certainly the long term does look positive. The rupee has been trending downwards for an awfully long time. Perhaps it would be better to look at it the other way around. And when we look at it on the long-term chart, it would be, I think, presumptuous to say that it has ended that it has already ended. If we zoom in a little, well, we've certainly had a rally in the rupee over the course of the last 5 months. It hasn't quite yet broken its sequence of lower rally highs, but what we are starting to see now is that it is back above its trend mean. And if it can sustain that move, and more importantly, if it can break onwards and upwards to new highs and sustain that, well, then we're talking about a very different environment. One of the reasons why the rupee has been so weak for so long has been because of the intransigent problem that they've had with deficit spending. Well, if India can develop a vibrant manufacturing sector that will boost exports and that will change their balance of payments. And more importantly, it will help to solve the deficit problem. And that will contribute to currency appreciation. Well, eventually that will become uncompetitive, but we're so far away from that potential flashpoint that there is the real potential over the medium term that we're going to have not only a strong stock market, but that Indian asset prices generally will do better. One of the other, I think, rather important points is when we start to think about the fact that there's a strong correlation between demographics and bond yields, then I think it's rather important to pay some due consideration to that potential, that it's very easy to conclude that we're going to have significantly higher government bond yields in the developed world over time. But if we simply look at the fact that there is a tight correlation between the median age and the yield on government bonds, and that's as true in emerging markets as it is in developed markets, then we're going to have a very clear change. Well, there are 100,000 people arriving on the US border, on the southern border, every month. Well, in the course of a year, that's 1.2 million people. And if that persists for let's just call it 3 years, well, then you're getting 1% of the population starting to make a new life in the USA. That has the real potential to, in fact, move the needle in terms of the median age. If we were actually going to talk about what could be one of the primary factors in pushing yields higher, it could be changing demographics. Well, that's a very long-term speculative prognostication. What we certainly saw in here this week, though, was that the yield did rise, and it is now back above 2.5%, particularly after today's move. And there is the potential now that it is going to push back up towards the region of the trend mean. Part of the reason that it would do that is because people are anticipating that a lot of the very bearish sentiment expressed at the end of last year, and the fact that we have had earnings expectations that are at their that have been revised down by the most since early 2016, that there's a very low bar now for earnings, that we could have a significant number of companies beating their earnings announcements, and that could propel stock markets higher. The fact that the CPI and PPI figures were a bit steadier than were anticipated. Investors are beginning to think that the pause in the Fed's monetary policy could persist a while longer, which would suggest that we're not going to have an interest rate cut imminently, and therefore that could help to put some further strength in the yield. One thing, though, is that we have a clear failed upside break above 3%. And there is potentially here the scope that we're going to see an unwinding of the overextension relative to the trend mean. But it's going to have to push above the trend mean in order to demonstrate that we're back in a supply-dominated environment beyond the short term. If we are in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market, then what we would anticipate is that the stock market should do better. That we would anticipate that that's exactly what would happen. A lot of people were talking about the fact that over the last few weeks we've had an inverted yield curve. That's really only at the extremities of the yield curve between the 3 month and the 10 year. We haven't had an inversion between the 10-year and the 2-year. Well, we're currently at around 16 basis points. Earlier in the week, we were at 14, but we're not negative. Generally speaking, as long as the yield curve is contracting, then that tends to the yield curve spread is contracting. That's generally supportive of performance in the stock market. Even after it becomes inverted, it's usually a lead indicator of anything from 6 to 18 months, and the stock markets continue to rally. When, for example, we look at the performance of the S&P 500 the last time round, the yield curve spread became inverted in around 2005. We had a very meaningful move off of the lows in 2006 and all the way through to the peak in late 2007. Well, the yield curve has not yet become inverted, and the market has rallied really very impressively. As I said, there is a low bar for earnings to beat expectations, so there is the potential here that the S&P 500 is going to trade up towards the 3,000 level. And the performance right now of high technology, like the semiconductors index, which was up an additional 20 points in here today and is extending its breakout from this range, that is a highly cyclical sector. Then we have the commodities complex, which is also highly cyclical and leveraged to the growth of the global economy, and it was up an additional 300 points on the FTSE 350 mining index in here today. When we look at the ASX resources index, it's also up to new recovery highs in here this week. When we look at, for example, one of the miners like Glencore, it's starting to play catch up here, and Rio Tinto has already broken out. These are all highly leveraged to the growth of the global consumer, but also to stimulus that is likely to feed through into the infrastructure sector. So that's an additional market that is likely to benefit. Then you have biotech. Well, the biotechnology sector hasn't really been taking off over the course of the last few months, and it was in negative territory this week. I'm thinking about the fact that going right back to what we started to talk about at the beginning of the broadcast is that capitalism trends towards consolidation, and regulation plays a significant factor in the ability of that to occur. And I saw this article in here this week, and it's about Chinese scientists starting to create human-monkey hybrids so that they can study intelligence. Well, apart from the parallels that that has with the Planet of the Apes movies from the late 1970s and early 80s and more recently, this very clearly highlights that there is no regulation in China. One of the points that was particularly interesting in the aftermath of the scandal about creating, or let me get the nomenclature correct. What was in fact done by a Chinese researcher was to directly edit the DNA of babies and then have those babies delivered. The point that was made at when that story broke was he was saying that it was in an attempt to bring the children to full term so that they would have an immunity to HIV. That was the thing that gained the most news. But what came out later was that he had also tried to make them more intelligent by altering a key part of their DNA. And One has to question whether that wasn't the ultimate aim of the experiment in the first place. Then we have this additional new story now that Chinese scientists are trying to play with intelligence with monkeys. Well, if you start to then string those two stories together and you put it against a background where China has zero ethical regulation of the biotech sector, in addition to the fact that it has a long history of harvesting organs from underrepresented portions of society, that this is a country that has got that can have abortions up to the 8th or even 9th month of pregnancy. So when we talk about zero regulation, what we're really talking about the Wild West of experimentation. Now, that does represent a challenge for the Western biotechnology sector, because they exist within a very highly regulated market environment. One of the byproducts of being active in a completely unregulated market is that China is going to develop a. Obviously, they are moving towards a solution to create more intelligent people. And that's obviously a key megalomaniac type ambition for the Chinese administration. It doesn't preclude the potential that they're also working on genetic weapons. That's something else as well. But again, when we think about the fact that capitalism trends towards consolidation, what that in fact means is that the strong will eventually overtake the weak. The fact that the biotechnology sector has not been performing the way that we would anticipate cyclical sectors to perform is potentially a symptom of the fact that they're being outcompeted by the complete absence of regulatory oversight in China. This represents a very significant challenge for the healthcare sector generally, because you can massively accelerate the testing, clinical trials, and human experimentation in a completely unregulated environment above that of the long permitting process that goes into play when we are talking about what goes on in terms of the regulatory environment in the West. This is all the more important when you look at Europe and the kind of regulation that is being imposed there. That is, in many respects, hamstringing the environment against a background where the competitors have no barriers to entry at all. So, when we start to look around the world, there is a clear potential that we are in a reflationary environment, that there is going to be additional upside in the market, that it's going to be driven by cyclical sectors. Right now, we're starting to see that the gold market has been weak in here this week. It was steady in here today, but it has got some proving to do that the $1,275 area is in fact an area of support. What there is the clear potential is that when growth does start to moderate, that gold will really start to shine because lower interest rates would have a clear incentive for people to favor a non-interest bearing and physical asset that cannot be lent into existence. But as long as stock markets are out competing, then that's likely to act as a headwind. But the fact that gold is also a cyclical sector should help to act as I think as a floor to prices, even during periods of weakness. when we think about where are we in terms of the longer term cycle, well, we're in a secular bull market. There is the clear potential that technological innovation is going to continue to lead on the upside, that it is going to deliver the kind of productivity gains that can continue to drive this secular bull market. I don't doubt that there is going to have to be some kind of reordering of society to quell the populist uprisings. There is obviously going to have to be a change in terms of globalization, considering that it was China's entrance into the WTO that resulted in millions of jobs being transferred from the West and into the East. So we're going to have to come up with a solution to that particular quandary if this reordering is going to occur. The kinds of solutions that are based on even more debt accumulation and even more social supports are impractical without productivity growth that can help to ultimately pay for them. And that's obviously where technological innovation is going to play a significant part. Then, of course, we have the rise of the global consumer. That's particularly in focus in India right now. But the other big area that has got a massive demographic dividend is Africa. It's by far the youngest continent, and we are starting to see that governance is improving, albeit coming off a very low base. And that also represents a significant opportunity over the long term, not only from within Africa for the companies that it can generate, but also for those that are doing business there. We're going to see recessions from time to time. It's inevitable that you cannot go through a secular bull market without seeing recessions. But what's generally to be expected if we are in fact in a secular bull market is that those recessions are not the kinds of crashes that we saw in 2000 and in 2008, but that they are more modest affairs. And with tightening credit conditions and the fact that this market has been maturing now and is already 10 years in the making suggests that we're not so far away from the next recession, that it could be within the next 2 years. We also have to bear in mind that we are in the third psychological perception stage of this market, where there is the potential for bubbly activity. We're also in the third year of the presidential cycle, and generally that has been a positive year, but that most of the bullish performance comes in the latter half of the year. So, considering that we are now in the middle of April, there is scope for some weakness between now and June, with the balance of the positive performance coming through in the latter half of the year and following through into a positive performance into the 2020 election year. And that would be very much in tune with what we see from an inverted yield curve over time, that it is usually after the market becomes or the yield curve becomes inverted that the market has another leg higher. So I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.